to Holden several, like 18 years ago, and knew Barb Rossing. So even though my wife is the person who is on the teaching staff here, Barb asked me to do some sessions while we were here. And she felt, since there's such a tremendous variety of musical expression and people here express such a tremendous variety of opinions and background in music, that it would be interesting for me just to talk about who I am as a musician who came very much out of the Lutheran tradition and Lutheran training. And instead of trying to deal with what kind of music should be happening in the church, which is what other sessions and forums I've participated in the last couple of weeks have been, I just say who I was and sort of through that explain why I do things the way I do. I'm from Minnesota originally. A very typical family. My mother's family is Norwegian Lutheran. My father's family is German Lutheran. Came from a small town west of the Twin Cities and went to an Augustana Synod Lutheran church every Sunday. I sang in the choirs at the church, sang in the choirs at my school. Minnesota at that time had a very strong music education program. I had the same music teacher first grade through ninth grade. And had her first through sixth 3 days a week for about 45 minutes a day, and then seventh through ninth I had her 5 days a week. I want to emphasize this because this was public school and this was opportunity that was available to everyone at that time without any kind of extra charge levied to the parents. And everybody that went through my public school system got the same training. And Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin are known for having very strong public school music programs, but they aren't anywhere near as strong now as they were back when I was going through them. I graduated from high school in 1967. My parents were not particularly musical, didn't push me in music. They were much more into, like most Minnesotans, hunting and fishing. And on weekends, we didn't hang around for choir if it was the opening of pheasant season. We went pheasant hunting. But I did have piano lessons starting in second grade for like 4 years, like so many kids do. You know, their parents just, well, we have a piano, let's have all our kids have a few years of piano lessons. But I would say that as a musician, it wasn't my family at all that pushed me into going into music. They were real lukewarm about it. It was the church primarily and the public school system, and it happens that in my public school system, which was also typical of Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, my public school music teachers were Lutherans. My elementary junior high teacher was a graduate of Augsburg College in Minneapolis, and my high school teacher was a graduate of Gustavus Adolphus. And they were trained in the sort of traditional Lutheran choral system, and back then those schools were turning out many public school music educators, and feeding them out into the public schools and the churches and church music programs in the Twin Cities. And ultimately what happened is the ones that were a little brighter lights would end up going to the Lutheran colleges, trying out for the choirs, and then the best ones would get into those Lutheran college choirs. I went to Minnesota All-State Choir between my junior and senior years in high school, and Weston Noble from Luther College was the director of Minnesota All-State, and I thought, oh, this is pretty neat. So I applied to Luther College, and I ended up going to Luther College. All over the country, in other places at the same time, there were other routes by which people were getting music education. I wasn't aware of that at the time. You only know where you came from, and I didn't realize how traditionally Lutheran and Midwestern my upbringing was. I ultimately went to graduate school at the University of Chicago with a lot of people who were neither Lutherans nor Midwesterners, and I began to see many entirely different ways of looking at music and education when I got there. But I think that the people that went through my school system all had the same opportunities that I did. I remember very clearly when I was in fourth grade, your classroom teacher was instructed in music education as well. That was part of the protocol they had to go through in their their methods classes in college. And on those days when we didn't have the special teacher come in, why, she would do something with us. And I remember doing melodic dictation at the blackboard. We'd put out the five lines on the blackboard, and she'd play something on the piano, and in teams we'd go up and write the notes. And I can't imagine that happening in any public school system today. But we did that, and my elementary and junior high were not particularly college-bound people. A lot of rural people and a lot of blue-collar people, and it wasn't that their parents pushed to have this program in the school, that's just what we had. And that's the kind of experience that they had. Now, when I went to a consolidated high school with lots of suburban kids who had much more professionally motivated and ambitious parents and who pushed their kids to go to college and get a good education, get good jobs and so forth, but that wasn't my town and that wasn't my church. My church just did this because that's what Lutheran churches do. We had choir on Wednesday and we had choir on Saturday and then we sang on Sunday. And I sang in a children's choir when I was 5 and I sang in a boys' choir when I was 8 and I sang in a youth choir when I was in about 7th grade, and then I started singing in the adult choir when I got to 9th grade. In addition, my high school choir director, who, as I said, was himself a Lutheran from Gustavus, started a group called the Philharmonic Society, and every year we did Messiah in our community. Now, we did Messiah with, you know, an electronic organ. We didn't hire any big orchestra or anything like that. I don't think we did a great job of it, and we only did about 45 minutes of it. But we did it every year at a Lutheran church in the area, and then a few times we did movements from the Mendelssohn Elijah, and we did the Haydn 7 Last Words of Christ in English. And I don't believe that any of this was very unusual back then. Certainly, I was never told that it was unusual. And when I got to Luther College in the fall of 1967, I had no intention of being a music major. My experiences were not special enough, nor was my display of talent special enough that I had been geared, you know, pushed into being a music major. I tried out for the choir, and I got into the freshman choir, and I thought that was pretty good, and I thought maybe I'd take some theory classes and see what it was all about, and I got into these theory classes, and there were all kinds of kids that had much more music education than I had. I was kind of scared in my freshman theory class at the level displayed by my fellow students. I ended up getting a music major at Luther, but as a matter of fact, when I was a junior, they had something they called a junior review where all the music faculty get together and discuss your performance to that point and what they felt was your potential. And I was advised to go into another field. They thought that I was too academic to be happy teaching on the public school level. And they thought that I probably didn't have good enough voice to ever be working on the college level or to be working professionally. And so they thought that I probably should go to graduate school in a different field and pursue an academic career. And what I ended up doing after I graduated from college was going to the University of Chicago in graduate school in the English program there. And as I said before, I don't think that the fact that I got a master's in English and started a PhD in English was anywhere near as important as the fact that I got out of Minnesota and Iowa and discovered that other people didn't do things at all the way we did back there. It was, you know, the closest major metropolitan place you could go from Decorah, Iowa, and I didn't want to go back to Minneapolis. That was too close to home. I got to Chicago and discovered that people do things a lot differently in other parts of the country than they did in the Midwest. I finished a master's degree and decided I really wanted to go into music anyhow, a year away from it, and having been told that I didn't have the talent for it, had all combined to convince me that I really want to do this anyhow. My parents were appalled. As I said, they were lukewarm about music anyhow, and they didn't think. This is also very typical of people from my background. They didn't think that it was a good job for a man. I remember my father saying to me, "You want to be some piano teacher someday, teaching piano lessons up above the fire barn?" See, that's where I'd taken my piano lessons, in the fire barn in our town on the second floor. And that was their view of professional music. But in Chicago, I just felt like I really missed music. So I got a job teaching. I came back, did my student teaching at Luther, or actually up in St. Paul, but through Luther, and got a job teaching public school in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, elementary and junior high. And sure enough, they were right. I really was far too academic to be teaching public school. I liked the kids fine, and I liked my own daughter tremendously. But when it came to the classroom, I wanted to do music, not be a traffic cop or something like that. And I was not very happy doing public school music. So I decided to go back to the University of Chicago. While I was there, I started singing in a choir that was sponsored by Chicago Theological Seminary, which, in the area in which I lived, Hyde Park, has got six separate theological seminaries. In addition to the University of Chicago Divinity School, there's the Lutheran School of Theology, there's Chicago Theological Seminary, there's Chicago Theological Union, there's Meadville Lombard Seminary, and McCormick Seminary, and in the Chicago area, plenty of other ones. It's called the Cluster, and you can study just about anything having to do with religion, right, staying in the area. And I went out for this Renaissance choir directed by a New Testament scholar, in fact, a Paul scholar named Robin Scroggs at CTS, and my very first rehearsal with this ragtag group of seminarians, he announced to us that no true church music had been written since the time of Bach. He had very, very strong feelings about what church music was, and he felt that from the end of the Baroque period on, music became much too performer-centered, much too secular, and that it no longer expressed the spirit of the scriptures. So he only performed music written before 1750. In fact, in Robin's case, we only before 1600. He was very narrow in his musical tastes. Well, I was kind of excited about this. This seemed to me to fit in a little bit with what I'd gotten growing up in the Lutheran Church, that music was worship. I had trouble as a student at Luther doing things like recitals at that time, standing up in front of people all by myself, just singing. It had been very difficult for me to justify that. And I remembered that my college choir director, Weston Noble, always said, "We're doing this for the glory of God. This is a ministry to the people," and so forth and so on. And all of that, that's what I'd grown up with. This is what I was comfortable with. So when Robin Scroggs said this in the middle of very ambitious University of Chicago atmosphere, personally ambitious, I felt, oh, I've found a friend here. You take a boy to the city and you can't keep him back on the farm. And my voice started developing. And I started being able to sing better and better and auditioning for other things and found a voice teacher and eventually dropped out of graduate school at the University of Chicago because I found that the singing was going pretty well for me. And of necessity, I started doing more and more solo work and studying more and more solo work, and found a teacher who was a St. Olaf grad named Elsa Charleston, who lived in our area and who herself had come from a very strong Minnesota. She was from Chisholm, Minnesota, had gone to St. Olaf, and she knew exactly how the struggles that I was having dealing with a professional musician's life coming from where I was coming. And so she was a very good counselor and friend for me during that time, and would tell me about auditions and tell me who I could stand to work for and who I couldn't and so forth. And I eventually did what all young singers, professional singers in Chicago do. I had a temple job at a temple up in Highland Park. Well, no, I started out in Skokie, but I didn't have a car, so I would take a bus to the L and take the L up to Howard Street, and then I'd get another bus to take and then a transfer to another bus, and an hour and 45 minutes later I would be at the temple where I was singing. And I'd rehearse there on Wednesday nights, and then I'd sing on Friday nights, and occasionally a bar mitzvah on Saturday. Then I got a church job that rehearsed on Thursday nights at Fourth Presbyterian Church downtown, right downtown in Chicago. And so Thursday nights I'd be there and Sunday mornings. Then I started singing in the Chicago Symphony Chorus, which rehearsed Mondays and Tuesdays. Sometimes on Wednesday I'd have to skip Temple to do a dress rehearsal with Chicago Symphony. Then during the summers I sang Grant Park Symphony Chorus. In the meantime, and lots of weddings and funerals, and you sort of network around. There are thousands and thousands of singers in a city the size of Chicago, and well, no clear indication of that is the number of W-2 forms you get for all the jobs that you do. And I, because I was studying voice, I started finding a little bit more of a solo voice of my own. This was important to me, particularly because of a young woman who was here for the last 5 weeks and just left yesterday, I think, Jamila Meyer, who's a music major, undergraduate music major on flute, and she's dropped out, and she's dropped her major, and she said that by doing all this technical work on her flute, she never felt that she had a voice of her own, that she was just doing traditional classical music that her teacher told her to do, but she didn't understand it. Well, this was really rang a bell with me, and I think it's even more true for a singer than it is for an instrumentalist. A classical singer in the United States, first of all, has to learn to use his body in a way that has nothing whatsoever to do with this. You have to be able to project from a stage all by yourself. Well, right away you've left popular music way behind you, because popular music is entirely electronics oriented. Then you have to produce a tone that's you know, clear and bell-like and even from top to bottom at a high volume level. You have to learn to sing in three or four different languages. Even if you don't know what they mean, you have to be able to pronounce them well, because every time you sing an audition, they say, well, bring something Italian, bring something French, bring something English, and maybe something German, you know. So you have to have all this stuff, and you have to know how to do it. And I mean, here we're in landlocked Midwest, and you have to take up these skills. You have to leave behind every possible vestige of popular music style. Now, I'm old enough that when I was a little kid growing up, my parents were listening to Frank Sinatra and Doris Day and Judy Garland and stuff like that. So the things that I've always had to fight was a crooning style in my singing. I always heard Frank Sinatra in one ear, and I would sing like that, and I had to get that completely ironed out of me. And after a while, I felt like, what am I worth? All I do is what other people tell me to do. So when Jamila was telling me of this problem of hers, I understood it very well. The classical style in anything is just plain hard. There's no two ways about it. There's nothing easy about doing something that's good. I'm absolutely convinced that that's true in every field. It certainly was in mine. Like many people who have a performer bent in them or an artist bent, I'm an escapist. I do things because they feel nice and warm and fuzzy, and I like them, and I want to cut corners, and I want to have people like me, and I want to do all that kind of stuff. And let me tell you, that has nothing to do with classical discipline. The discipline to do what I had to learn to do was something that I had to be prodded and pushed and criticized and made to feel very small. You work at that time when I was working for all these different conductors, and you sing for somebody, and they say, that sounds terrible. Who makes you think you're a singer? And you just sort of lick your wounds and go home and go sing for the next one. It happens all the time. And you get a job. I remember Fourth Presbyterian very clearly. I'm a high baritone as a singer. He hired me as his bass section leader, and then we got some low notes, I couldn't sing them, and he says, I need more bass here. This is right before Easter. He's pretty nervous. I tell you, professional church music is not grace-filled about Lent and Advent. It's just a lot of screaming and yelling. And he yelled, I need more bass here. And I said, I don't have those notes. You know I don't have those notes. He says, young man, for what I'm paying you, you can sing those notes. I went through a period where I was quitting jobs a lot, because I just felt, who dares yell at you for doing something you love to do? I wasn't brought up that way. That bothered me a great deal, and it still does, as a matter of fact. I mean, I still get real hot when somebody doesn't respect what I'm trying to do. Well, as I was saying, this discipline took several years. It takes a long time. And I studied with a lot of different teachers, coached with a lot of different pianists and conductors, ended up in these last 10 years or so going to Europe several times and spending the summer in vocal institutes in France and Sweden to brush up my European language skills and to learn style. I sang master classes for every time anybody would come through Chicago or someplace nearby. I would send in a tape and get in on a master class thing where you go and sing for somebody like L.A. Amling or Hermann Pry or Peter Pears or somebody, and they criticize you and help shape your style. And through these opportunities, I made contacts that then I was able to make more use of. Like when I've studied in Europe, I've gone over specifically to study with French baritone named Gérard Souzet and his accompanist Dalton Baldwin, who really have been very helpful to me in helping me to learn classical style. And you know, I'm now 43 years old, and I'm only now beginning to feel confident that the classical style is mine. It takes that long. If I were French or German, it might be different. If I'd grown up in the sort of household that Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau describes in his autobiography, where they listen to this music constantly and only go to the best concerts, and everybody is so educated that it's unbearable, and they all speak five languages around the dinner table. But I didn't. I was a Lutheran from Minnesota, and like I say, on Saturday, we'd go hunting or fishing, not to choir practice. So it took me a very long time to pick all of this stuff up. I think that what I did learn from my family in all of this, though I did not learn music from them, there are certain virtues that we people back there share. I remember my grandfather talking about my father a few years ago. My father is a gruff person, and my wife encountered my father and found him to be a gruff person. She asked my grandfather, "What's with him?" Because my grandfather's a very jolly guy. He says, "Well, you got to get to know Cecil, because he acts that way, but what he does is always quality. And if he says it, he really means it." And I think that is not atypical of a person that comes from a farm in western Minnesota and lived through the Depression and stuff like that. What he says, he really means. And he doesn't always smile about it, and he can be a man of very few words, but you know you can lay your life in his hands. And I have one brother that runs a restaurant in Paris, if you can believe it, a bar and restaurant in Paris, and two brothers that farm in Minnesota. They're truck farmers. So we've all gone very different ways, and I'm the only college graduated one in my family. But when we get together, we always joke about my father being that way, and we've all worked on the farm together during harvest, and you're picking tomatoes, you know, you're going through them and say, "Ah, this isn't Tamman quality," and it splats on the ground. "Okay, this is Tamman quality," and we put a little sticker on that says Minnesota grown, put it on there and proudly present it to the produce manager at the store. Well, it's fun and it's kind of a joke, but you know, we really mean it. That a thing that I learned in my family that has really sustained me through all of this is, there's no sense in doing it unless it's really good. That can have problems. You can be unforgiving. You can be judgmental as a result of that, and you can be impatient with people that you believe should be living up to higher standards than they want to live up to. And I certainly suffered from that from time to time, a feeling of tremendous insecurity about what I'm doing. I'm competing in a very difficult field with people that have tremendous talent and resources and background. And it's easy for me to feel insecure about what I'm doing and just sort of melt and go like that and think, "Oh, let them do it, let them do it." But I've always been able to bounce back from that. And I'm not sorry that that is a virtue that my family ground into me when I was a child. Another thing that I think I really got from my family was that music has got to have some sort of meaning. Now, it isn't that they thought music had to mean anything. They didn't think it meant anything. But they did it did matter within my background that whatever you did had to matter to the people around you, had to change people's lives, had to make the world a better place. Whether it's that you run a restaurant around, like my brother does in Paris. He runs specifically a restaurant for foreigners. And and I don't know if you've ever been to Paris, everybody talks about how you get off the plane and right away they speak French to you. And you go, what do I do? They try to talk English and you talk English and they're rude to you. It's not always that way, but frequently it is. So my brother has this restaurant right in the very middle of the old part of Paris, in the 5th arrondissement, and these people come in looking very bewildered, like Paris has just been slapping them around. He greets them in English, and he says, have a cup of coffee, can I help you with something? And he knows where the hostels are in the neighborhood, along the way, he's built a tremendous business for himself, because he's famous in Paris for being able to deal with foreign people. But he does this because it's important to him that he provide a service. And just like my brothers that farm, it's very important to them that they provide good food to the people who buy from them. And it's important to them as they are slowly but surely moving into organic farming, that they're able to provide good food for people that's healthy for them, and they guarantee all of their stuff. And if you buy a melon from Tamman Farms and it's green, you just bring it back, or you don't even have to bring it back, they just give you another one. We all have this almost neurotic sense that we really want to stand behind what we do, that it matters to other people and that we're providing people with things. Well, that's sort of a long thing, but it has to, but music can be seen as just entertainment, and musicians can be seen as very lightweight people. And that's a struggle that I always had as I was working my way into the musical profession. What is this worth to anybody? I feel that very much, particularly when hardly anybody comes to a concert that you give, for instance, and you think, here I am standing up here, somebody spent some money to hire me to sing a concert, and hardly anybody came, and who likes this music anyhow? Is this really worth it? And I have a hard time with that. I don't like to just go collar people and say, listen to me, I'm good. I want to be giving them something that they already want. In terms of church music, this gives me trouble because I'm very much a traditional classical musician. Along the way, I got into doing more and more choral conducting, and I like to I like my groups to sing the masterworks. I like Palestrina, and I like Bach, and I like Mozart, and I like Victoria, and Brahms, and Schubert, and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of the churches don't want this music anymore. I mean, you don't have to look any farther than the Village Center at Holden Village. People want very much to have music that is much simpler than that, much more based on popular styles, music that you don't have to have any particular education to be able to perform or appreciate. And I begin to feel like the music that I have learned to do has no validity as part of a worship service or for worship. And that's something that really digs under my fingernails a little bit. I get very tense that I want to do a kind of music that other people don't want to do anymore. But the other side of that is that I keep on striving to make it meaningful. I want to do the music that I'm good at. I see no sense whatsoever in my throwing away all my years of training and experience to do something that I'm not trained to do. It's important to me to accept the limitations of what I know, and to have a vertical experience of what I do, to get better and better and better at performing Bach rather than decide to sort of perform Bach and sort of perform Marty Haugen. It that makes no sense to me at all. I don't believe that one can perform Bach really well and do that, or perform Mozart really well. These people, composers like this that are at the very peak of the Western art, it takes utter commitment and concentration on your part to do it. I've struggled along the way to be able to justify doing all of that, to perform music by dead white men, as my students call it. And all I can say is, I absolutely believe in this stuff, that I find it to be a revelatory experience for me, and as a teacher, I find it to be a revelatory experience for my students, and that there is something spiritual and universal and that I can't describe, that I can't quantify, that happens. This year, I conduct choirs and an orchestra in the Bach B minor Mass, and we spent 6 months learning it. It was really hard, and it came off pretty well. It could come off better, but you know, we worked really hard at it. And I tell you, my students, not a one of them afterwards felt like this was nothing but music by dead white people. They felt like, as I felt, as though the roof of Rockefeller Chapel came off, and the spirit entered and surrounded us. I can't justify doing this music in any other way than to say it. I just know it. It's just really good, and it's not easy. It's not at all easy to do the kind of music that I love to do. I was saying in a forum last week when we were talking about this very sort of thing, the conflict between newer, simpler, more popular styles of music in the church and the stuff that I like. I was saying, you know, the problem with doing both for a musician is that you have to, in order to do Bach, you have to be absolutely in tune. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And to be in tune, to sing in tune, to play in tune, you start when you're a kid and you train your ear to be in tune. You never are allowed to approximate pitch. You can't sing da 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 and sing Bach. It just doesn't work. If you're singing an a cappella four-part chorale, if there's something that's as out of tune as that, the whole thing doesn't work. It's a very rarefied air that you live in when you do high-level classical music. Or classical's the wrong word. I guess music that has lived for a long time and is still living with us is the word that I should be using. And a lot of popular styles don't require anything like that sort of intonation on the part of the performer any more than they require the projection of tone. The kind of tone that I make when I sing is just inextricably wrapped with the fact that I sing loud enough to be heard without a microphone. If I don't sing that loud, I'm going to make a different sort of tone. And the composers that wrote the music that I sing were writing for that kind of tone that gets heard without a microphone. So if you grow up always singing and performing with electronic equipment, electronic instruments, with a mixer, with all that kind of stuff, you build your musical instrument, your voice, and your ears in an entirely different way. And I don't know anybody that successfully goes back and forth between those things. I don't in this make... I honestly do not make a value judgment about this, because I know that there are people many people feel very alienated by the kind of music in which I specialize. And I'm sorry they feel alienated, and I wish they would all come to my concerts by my choirs and be reinvigorated in this music. But I know that for a lot of them they feel that a more popular style does speak to them where they are. I know that for myself, in raising my children, I want my children to know a classical style. I don't know how that's gonna work when they get to be a certain age and they say, well, hey, that's old fogey music and I'm not interested. I don't know what I'll do. I'll just cross that bridge when I come to it. But I want them to know that it exists. I would say, I notice as a college choral conductor, almost none of my students come from anything like the background from which I come. In the first place, almost none of my students are Lutheran or from the Midwest. A good third of my students are Jewish and come from Long Island or Connecticut, something like that, you know. Or they come from other bastions of the upper middle class and went to private schools and didn't have anything like the choral experiences that I had. And even were this 20 years ago, they still wouldn't be having those experiences, because I've learned that what we had in the Midwest was very special and most places in the country didn't have anything like it. And when they come to audition for me when they're 18, 19, or 20 years old, they come in making some pretty squawky sounds. that won't work very well in the kind of music that I want to do. But they are my constituency. They're the people that I am paid to deal with and to train and to make choirs out of. And so I am very intense with them. I do my very best to get them to sing in my terms a lot better than they do when they come in. And the thing that I've discovered is that my program has grown by leaps and bounds because an awful lot of these people really think it's worth it. Now that may be because I teach at a very academic institution where the students have, you know, very high test scores and a very high level of material culture, and there's a certain snob appeal to doing, you know, long-haired music or something. I don't know exactly why it is, but my students think it's worth it, and an awful lot of them take private voice lessons. An awful lot of them want to improve and want to produce sound in a better way than they had been doing previously, or in my terms, a better way than they had been doing previously. And so that even though I don't conduct anything like the St. Olaf Choir, my students are pretty proud of what they do, and they feel like they learn a great deal, and they go out of there saying, you know, Bach really is important. He is one of the seven wonders of the Western world, and Palestrina is a pretty important composer to know about, and Mozart is really hot, isn't he? And I'm glad they do that, and I there's a part of me that says, I wish everybody would have that same experience, so they'd all know that. But I guess when I decided that I would give this talk, what I decided to do was be unabashed in saying that that's the kind of music that I do, and that's what's really important to me, and I can't, and that it's important to me as a teacher to say to my students outright when they get there, this is what we do. And when you decide that you're going to participate on the college and university level in my program and in the choirs that I conduct, this is the kind of music that you're going to sing. And that I am not judging the other kind of music that you might prefer to do instead, and I'm not saying that you're required to do this and there's something wrong with you if you don't, but that I really feel that I have to do a narrow thing deeply. That's important to me. I spent one summer at an art school in Northeast Iowa called South Bear School of Pottery and Painting, and it was the teacher there was named Dean Schwartz, and he was the ceramics teacher at Luther College. He, in fact, was the teacher of George Lau, who's the potter here in the village right now. And we were at Luther at approximately the same time. And Dean had a very narrow protocol that he required all of his pottery students to go through. He had certain tools that you had to use, and you couldn't use any other tools. And he had a certain way that you mixed the clay, certain way that you centered it on your wheel, and you had to start by making a doggy dish. And you went from a doggy dish to a cream pitcher, and from there to something else, and from there to something else. Everybody had to do exactly the same thing, and it all had to look exactly alike. And for the first couple of weeks, he'd walk around and say, well, that's getting better. And then he'd take out his paring knife and destroy your pot, throw it in the trough, and you'd start over again. And this was kind of appalling for young people who wanted to be artists. They'd say, where is the art in this? It happened that this was a very successful school, and that wonderful potters were coming out of it, and people who ended up in other artistic disciplines but had gotten this kind of training from Dean. So I didn't doubt him, but I was fascinated by seeing how ruthless he was about doing this. And the Des Moines Register came up one day when we were there and interviewed people and took photos and interviewed Dean about this very thing. He says, we're not into art at this school, we're into craft. And you have to learn your craft and the tradition of your craft absolutely before you start making art out of it. Art is a long way down the road and I never even talk about it. After I'm dead, somebody will go to some museum where one of my pots is and maybe they'll say, well, this is art. He says, but I can't worry about that. I have to master my discipline, master my craft, and then whatever is inside me, whatever spirit has been breathed into me and comes out from my hands into this thing will show. I've never forgotten that, because that's very much different than the romantic idea of art that we all picked up in the late 18th, 19th centuries, and still surrounds us like smoke in the air, that I must express my inmost feelings and my inmost heart and pull this from my toes and this from my ears and everything to be me. And what Dean was saying is, that's nuts. I just want you to learn to make the perfect doggy dish. And from there we go to the next step. And well, I got to Chicago and I went through many voice teachers, and I got through a voice teacher named Hermanus Bayer. And I had no choice but to trust him, because he was a voice teacher of many famous singers, including Cheryl Milnes, who was at that time the biggest name in baritone, very baritone at the Met. And so, you know, you pay this guy $50 an hour, which was quite a lot of money back in 1980, let me tell you. It's still a lot of money. And he said to me, "Bruce, I believe you are an artist inside yourself. I believe you have a lot of feeling for this music, but what I want you to do is to learn to breathe properly and sing in tune." And week after week, I'd stand there and he'd put his hands around my chest and he'd feel what I was doing. He says, "Now make this sound." I'd say, "I don't like that sound." He says, "I don't care whether you like that sound, just make that sound." And I would have to do that. I never got to do any repertoire. I never got to sing any pretty songs. All I did was stand there being prodded and poked and being told, "Breathe like this, do this, do this." It's a very exacting skill to learn to breathe loudly enough to stand on the stage at the Met and be heard in the back row. I could not to this day do it. I don't have that big a voice, but I can sing a lot louder than I used to be able to, and a lot better as a result of what he was doing. But he believed that, and this was a very strong philosophy with him, he says, if you produce the tone physically in the best possible way, 3/4 of the battle is already won. He says, I can't teach you to be an artist. I can't teach you to breathe any kind of life into this stuff, any kind of soul into this. I can't make what you do different than what the other person does. All I can do is help you to do what the other person does. I can help you to have a craft. I can help you to always sing in tune and to be able to sing all the notes in your range and be able to pronounce all of your languages properly. Well, this was echoed then when I was studying one summer in France with this pianist named Dalton Baldwin. And this was after a session, and he was sort of tired and having lunch and so forth. He said, "You know, all these singers come from all over the world to these programs in the summer." And he says, "Most of them, frankly, will never be artists. And it's not that they won't learn the technique for it, but that to be an artist at that level, it's got to be something that's special, a special gift. And I can't, I can sit at the piano and I can pull something out of them and pull something out of them and pull something out of them, but it's like giving them a blood transfusion. As soon as I pull that tube out of them, they are not going to be an artist at the level that I want to deal with." And I thought that was very harsh. I thought that was very harsh of him to say it, but I guess I never, it's another one of those things that lodged in my mind that I never forgot. He was giving, as all these people are, a rather elitist view of what art is, that you have to do your very best, and as you do your very best, the other people get sloughed off and it's very painful for them, and then the best ones show. And that's a very painful thing for a person going into the arts. It's extremely difficult, and I can understand very much why people want to throw this out and say, "Look, I want to do music that's easy for me and simple for me and that I can feel good about." I really can understand that. There are many points in my life at which I want to do the very same thing. But the fact is that I have chosen a profession where that always striving for the very best is my meat and potatoes. Do any of you have any comments about this, criticisms of this approach, or stories of your own to relate?
I just want to know if you can play organ too.
No.
Because we, no, that's too bad. We could use you at St. Andrews. We need more classical music at St. Andrews.
I guess I would, you know, the chapel at which I conduct on Sundays is sort of a museum. I would not say that very much spirit breathes through that place from one year to the next. And it's a shame. We have money. It's called Rockefeller Chapel, and now you know why we have money. And we pay our choir. And the students and others who sing in the choir wouldn't come on Sunday if we didn't pay them. And we do very good music, you know, and we sing in a choir loft that's a good deal above the heads of the 55 or 60 people in this 1,200 seat capacity place. And they say, well, we come here for the music. It feels like you're in heaven and the angels are singing to you. Well, I don't know, that's not a very living faith to me at all, and I'm always a little embarrassed that I work there, frankly. I don't know whether I should have that on the tape or not, but it that does bother me. I wish there was more life in there. And then on the other hand, I say, yeah, but I don't want to be a musician at a church where I have to do a different kind of music. I would like to do this music and have it mean something for the spiritual lives and faith of the people worshiping there. I don't have an answer to that at all. Churches in Chicago who invest in fine classical music by professional choirs, it seems to me, are primarily investing in a sort of an aesthetic, museum-like atmosphere. And that people come there to appreciate this aesthetic experience, and somehow that translates as religion for them. I'm generalizing horribly. There are probably people for whom that is not true, but in my experience, and I've sung it in several professional church choirs in Chicago, that's kind of what it's like. And I never would belong to a church like that. The church that my wife and I belong to has a terrible choir, but they love to sing, and it means a lot to them. And my wife directs a children's choir at that place, and she has six or seven little kids singing out of tune, but they love it, and their parents love to have them do it. And somehow, I'm very torn by that, because I think she has a much better experience with her Sunday choir than I have with mine.
But we have the musicians and the ability to do good music, and we have done some good music. I just like to see us do more. We do. And there are other members of the choir. In fact, some of them drop out because we don't do enough classical music. And almost what we need at St. Andrews is two choirs. A more popular choir and a choir that concentrates more on the classics, because we have enough people to do that. And we don't have to pay anybody. I mean, we've got plenty of really fine musicians in our congregation. So you just gave me an idea. I'm on worship and music.
How many of you come from parishes where you feel that you have a very good church choir that does like classical repertoire? Are you happy with that? Or do they sing in foreign languages?
Not even.
Latin?
Our church sings a variety of music. It sings, you know, some of the more popular, but it also sings some of the more classical. I think it pleases everyone.
It does.
With that kind of...
That's why I'm saying we should use two choirs, because we could have the ones that do the more popular stuff, but some of us really don't care to do that much, and let them do the stuff like that. And those of us who prefer to stay with Bach and Mozart and even some modern composers who do good music.
Yeah.
You know.
We have a church right in our neighborhood, a Catholic church, that's done that. They have a guitar mass sandwiched between two traditional masses. And in that particular circumstance, what's happened is that it's like two different congregations, two different parishes, two different directors of music. They just happen to share the same building. And there's quite a good deal of enmity between the two music directors,
too.
And they talk about who draws a bigger crowd, stuff like that. And I think that's kind of a problem.
Just to briefly build on that, I go to a church where we have much of that same thing, although we tend to sing more traditional, I would call traditional music or classics, but we have three different liturgies. We have a Marty Haugen, Ray McKeever, and Green Book, LBW. And we don't announce we don't have a set standard of when it'll be done, so that people won't show up when they like their first letter.
Yeah.
So they come at what time they're
at,
whatever time they usually come, and it's up for grabs.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
Yeah, that's an intriguing. Yeah.
Strange, nice thing that's available in the Northwest, especially in Seattle, is the Abendmusik concerts that are provided by George Shangro in the Seattle Seattle Orchestra, it's called.
Chamber Chorus.
And then they have a chamber chorus. And he's one of the announcers on classical music, King FM, and has a fine understanding of, I think, the tradition, but also the molding together of vocal and instrumental music. And it's done good. It's probably not the quality that you're talking of, but it's certainly in that direction, and that comes out of the Unitarian Church. And we drive gladly 30 miles one way to go to those concerts.
Now, are they in a concert setting? I mean, you have tickets and so forth and so
right.
on, or is it?
Right.
It is.
It's, and his wife is a Methodist minister who heads a Unitarian seminary in San Francisco. George's.
The other thing we have in Seattle is Compline at St. Mark's Cathedral at 9:30 on Sunday nights. And that is magnificent. St. Mark's is ugly inside, but the acoustics are marvelous.
Yeah, that's something I've often heard about. I sang for a year at Holy Name Cathedral in Chicago, where Richard Prue is the director, and he used to be in Seattle and talked about that program. Well, yeah, I think Seattle's a prettier town than Chicago. I can't dispute that with him. there is a problem about language in all of this. I like languages. I think that's reflected in the fact that I did graduate work in English. I mean, language and poetry is important to me, and I've studied a number of foreign languages, and I really enjoy just the sounds of them and the way they work in poetry. And to be a leader singer, that is a song singer, recitalist, when you attempt to perform at that high a level, you have to deal with the way the composer set every single darn word in the poetry, and to do it in translation doesn't work at all.
Right.
To do Winterreise in English would be kind of absurd. It's because Schubert knew what he was doing with German. But when you perform in church, I think, I don't know exactly what I think about that, frankly. You know, the operas in Chicago for a long time, we have something called Chicago Opera Theater, and just for practical economic reasons, they performed everything in English because they thought the audiences would like that more. Well, the audiences want to hear it in Italian. They want to hear it in German, so now they do subtitles. And that's the wave of the future. So you know what's going on, but you can still enjoy the sounds of the foreign language. Yeah.
I belong to a Scandinavian chorale, and we sing in 5 different languages, none of them being English. And we sing in Swedish, Danish, Icelandic, Finnish, and Norwegian.
Yeah.
And when I joined the group 3 years ago, it's like we had like 60 pieces that I had to learn. And it's like, well, I had to do them all phonetically.
Yeah.
For the most part, just, you know, listen and try to get it. It was a joke at first in that I had all the vowels right, but I didn't have the consonants because I would just listen to, and I could get the sustained tones, but I missed a lot of the interim parts. And so it's taking quite a while for me now on a lot of these pieces that I've been singing 3 years, and you know, I can...
Where is this choir?
It's called Stambandet.
And where? What city?
Boston.
Boston, for heaven's sake.
They've got one in
wonderful.
Seattle, too.
That sounds wonderful.
Sweet.
Yes.
But do you feel that it's worth it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. This is a 14 voice choir. We do all our music a cappella and without music.
They've improved over the 3 years. I go to a lot of the concerts, get so many friends in there, and it's amazing just the difference of working week after week after week and perfecting the sound and the tone mix.
Well, it's different when you've got 14 as opposed to however many.
Yeah.
half the group are natives, so. And just one other thing on that, and you were saying about people wanting things in Italian and German and stuff like this. You know, we have concerts. People don't know what we're singing. It's not like Minneapolis where you've got all these, suites and
nobles. I was going to say Boston, of all places, they have a Scandinavian choir.
And especially, when we sing on Icelandic, we certainly don't have any people around that. But people, we don't, for the most part, we don't supply words to what we sing. We just sing it. We give an explanation of, well, this is the type of mood, or this is what's happening in the piece. But, people tend to really appreciate it even without knowing exactly what it is that's more feeling.
For a professional American singer, it goes without saying that almost everything you'll sing is not in English. There's just not that much music written in English that's considered world-class vocal music. But Americans on the whole don't speak more than English. And it's kind of a problem we have here, particularly if we like to travel. With my choirs, I figure, well, these people came to the University of Chicago and are spending $25,000 a year to be here, all because they want to be well-educated. So, by God, they're going to sing in foreign languages. And we do something in Swedish or Norwegian every year, and we do things in German and French and Latin and Church Slavonic. And I can justify that with an academic choir. I can say, and they're excited about it. They want to learn to do it. And they work hard at it, and they feel it's part of the educational process. And afterwards, if you say, well, let's do this piece in English, say, oh, no, let's do it in German. Let's do it. But in church, you're not exactly giving your listeners or your choir, well, I don't know, are you giving them the option of understanding or not understanding, even if you print the words? Do they feel alienated by this?
Yeah, for me, singing this, it's like my Swedish has gotten a lot better in the past 3 years.
I'll bet.
And so it doesn't make a definite difference. It's like, well, I know what I'm singing about now, as opposed to I have an idea of it. I know, oh, well, this word means this, but this word means this, and altogether they have a constant thought, as opposed to, well, I can pick up this word and this word out of these 50.
Well, the Mendelssohn, how lovely is thy dwelling place. I performed that a couple times in English. And George Shango was conducting at the Seattle Symphony Chorale Sing-Along. And we did it in German, and I speak German. And there's no comparison. I don't ever want to do it in English again, ever. The words fit the music in German. It's beautiful in English, but it's nothing compared to what it is in German.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that hard to understand, actually. The German words are enough like English that you can more or less figure it out. You only need to put a few words of translation in for people to listen and be able to hear what's being said. Because the music tells you what's being said.
Yeah. I think that my mother, for instance, would, she just, if something is in a foreign language, she just sort of blanks out. it's a problem for her, and although she would be willing to accept that in a professional performance, she would feel that in church has to be hers. My mother likes church, and she wants it to relate to her personally, and she would have trouble with that. And it would not matter to her if you were to say, as I absolutely agree with you, the shape of the line expresses the German or French or whatever text much more than it does the English translation. She would say, yeah, but I didn't come here for that. So I think that's a real problem. And a problem that's a specific aspect of a very large problem which has driven so many people away from traditional European based music in our church. And I hope there's some way of combining these things in the long run. Change happens all the time, doesn't it? That's the way things go on. We're about out of time, but does anybody have any closing comment or question that we could leave hanging in the air? Yeah.
Just finishing, well, I don't know finishing it up, but extending it, what it seems like there are some people who can understand the music regardless of what the words are, and those that don't have a way of interpreting it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, well, now we'll see what we have in store for music tonight on the other side of town here.